morning to each everyone. Greet you in Jesus' name. It's a privilege to be here to share what God has done in a life, right? We all have a story. We all had received, you were born again. It was individually, right? It wasn't everybody got saved at once. And we all have a different experience. And my experience probably will resonate with some of you people that weren't raised Mennonite more. And those that are Mennonite maybe is a little different. But hopefully it's a blessing for everyone. Appreciate the service thus far this morning. It was singing was good. Enjoyed the Benjamin's children's lesson. And there was a lot of good word in there. So I want to start a little bit, little background on my parents, a little different than most. They were both Dutch immigrants that came from Holland. But my dad, what was kind of unique about him, his father was a military man. He was born in Indonesia, a very dark, superstitious country. And he was born there, and his mother, the marriage wasn't real good. Grandpa was I never met him, but he was a military guy, moving around a lot. Marriage was, Americans would say a shotgun wedding, but there was no shotgun involved. In other words, she was pregnant. So he married her. And so my dad had two older brothers, and then he came along, and she didn't want him. And so she had a lot of, they call them papuas. They were natives that would help clean the house, kind of, I don't know, for lack of better terms, almost like a slave. But she would have them punch her stomach because she didn't want the child. And, excuse me for this, but my dad was told about this later on in life. And so he lived his whole life knowing he wasn't wanted. He wasn't, that his mother didn't care for him. And that kind of carries on in kind of my past a little bit with my dad. And his mother was kind of in the witchcraft. She was into seances. She was really into a lot of dark stuff. I had the privilege to go back to Holland last year as we were going to visit Elijah in Ukraine. And I got to see some of the area where my dad lived in Holland, because they kind of went back and forth a little bit from Indonesia back to Holland. And I, through my older cousin, which was his oldest brother, told me some of the darkness and some of the things that went on. And it kind of made me realize the power of darkness, but yet the power of light. And how some of the decisions that my parents made allows me to be here today. Decisions that were for the right. And I think it's really important. I just thought I'd take a minute. I have my whole family here. And I know like Bob and Roger and the Shams, they remember me from when we first showed up in Oregon. A lot of you don't know us. And so I just want to introduce my family. If you don't, you guys don't mind standing up. My wife is in the back there, and then there's my oldest son, Willem, and Ezra, and his wife, Sharon, and I'm going to say it wrong, Eliza, I said it right, and Lydia, and that's my oldest daughter, Faith, and then over in the back here, I have my other son, Isaiah, and his wife, Lola, and my granddaughter, Talisa, and then Elijah, and Hope. You can be seated. Thank you. So that's a little bit of background. Dutch immigrants. So I was very Dutch, very raised Dutch, and I was born in Redwood City, California, in a hospital called Sequoia Hospital, kind of Redwood. And with two Dutch immigrant parents, Holland became inside her home. America was outside, but Holland was inside. We ate Dutch, we lived Dutch, we thought Dutch, we spoke Dutch, and then we step outside and we were in America. That's just how it was. And it was great until it's gone, right? And everybody dies off and you miss it. At about 2.5, I burnt my feet on a beach. It was very dramatic. Somebody had a barbecue and they took their hot coals and they stuck it up on this little ledge. For some reason, at a 2.5-year-old curious boy wanted to see what was going on over there. There's another fellow up there flying a kite, and I walked right in on those coals. and I burnt my feet horribly bad. I just stand there screaming. And my mother came, and she grabbed me, and she stuck my feet in that salt water, which was actually a good thing, but the skin was falling off like hot bubble gum, just peeling off. To this day, I still have a problem with that one foot, but that really affected me kind of emotionally, my grandparents said. It just really took the kind of the life out of me. Otherwise, I think it would have been more like Elijah. He's a little bit more fired up than I am. I think this kind of stunned me a little bit. During that whole time, my mom and dad were not Christians. We were living in a little town called La Honda, very rural little area out of south of San Francisco. And there was a Seventh-day Adventist couple, and somehow they led my mom and dad to the Lord. My dad smoked cigars, and they drank wine. They always had a big gallon of Carl Rossi in the kitchen table there, the counter. And they got born again, and dad said, I think he finished the bottle off and he quit drinking. And the cigars went, my mom quit smoking cigarettes. And through that, my mom became kind of the spiritual leader of the home. And out of default, my dad just wasn't that leader. And we were going to a little church. I was approaching about 5 years old. And she kept saying, you need to ask the Lord into your heart, you know, the sinner's prayer. And so at five, in the hallway of that new house they had built, I remember getting on my knees and asking the Lord to come into my heart, asking to forgive my sins and say the sinner's prayer. And so I thought I was in. That was it. And that was affirmed by many preaching and teaching that that's all we needed. My dad was he was an adventurist. Through his military and all over the world, he, being the youngest, he wanted to venture out to the New World, which is the U.S. His brothers and his mother stayed behind, and he was about 31 years old, and he headed out to America, and I think his sponsors were in Idaho. So he just had this adventurous blood in him to always conquer, try something new, and which was kind of interesting. And even though we had a brand new house in California, the hippies were kind of moving in 1968, 69. They were kind of homesteading in these rural areas out of San Francisco. And I think my dad saw a vision maybe for his children that this is not what he wanted. And he wanted to go north. And so by north, I meant British Columbia, Alberta, way north. He was buying books, how to build log cabins, how to do your own thing. We're going to homestead. He's going to go big or go home. And so in 1969, we have a 1960 Volkswagen with a 36 horse, and we're heading out. We're going to go check out this place, and my sister and me in the back seat, mom and dad in the front, trunk plump full of Coleman stoves and wool blankets and Dutch all the way. We ate at every rest stop. We camped, set a tarp out, and we slept open air, bears in the garbage cans. I mean, it was a venture for a five-year-old. It was great. And they went all the way up to Vancouver Island, where the capital of BC was. And there I saw a picture of my dad holding the papers of to where he could homestead the next year. I think we went up to Banff Park. We did this huge tour in this little car. Used to suck in behind a semi-truck just so we can get pulled up the hill because the thing was so underpowered. And they still do that, Ben? Cars got too much power now. Yeah, that was a Volkswagen trick. So the following year, they sold the house. And after they paid the mortgage, bought a new pickup, horse trailer, and they had the little V-dub. They had $15,000 cash, late 69. That's a lot of money. 15 grand is a lot of money. And we went up Highway 101. Seemed like it took 3 years, but I'm sure it was only 2 weeks. Camper and a horse trailer. For some reason, the dumb horse and the sheep had to come along. Two cats and two dogs stuffed in the bug. And we trekked out and stopped at state parks all the way up, got all the way up to the Blaine border and got pulled over to check your papers and all that. And it had to have been the Lord, but it was disappointing, but they wouldn't let us through. We could not go. They said, too many people are homesteading up here. They're making a disaster, leaving huge messes. If you can prove that you have $30,000 cash, we'll let you through. 15 short. So to the state park we went, and there was this man named Henry Weens. Henry Weens. He was a state park guy, and he said, hey, you can bring your caravan over to our place, and you can stay there as long as you need. He had a little single-wide mobile home. Him and his little wife, she had a wooden leg, first wooden leg. She could literally take that thing off and lean it up on the wall. What the world? And she'd put that thing back on, and they're a lot different today. But Christian people, we stayed there. Seemed like a year, but I'm sure it was only 2-3 weeks. But then Mom and Dad went house shopping, and they finally found this little place way rural, out of Bellingham, on a 3-mile dead-end road with little dairy farms, and they found 25 acres, about 15 wooded with a river. Almost a homestead place, river in the back, and some cleared land, cute little house, and that's pretty much where I grew up. I think they paid $22,000. $22,500, and it was kind of hard to make the $70 or $75 house payment. Isn't that something? And that was a good upbringing. Oh, it was beautiful. Everybody had 50, 60 acres around you, rural. The biggest dairy farm on the road had 60 cows, and the smallest maybe 20. Beautiful area. Just walk around, play in the river. Good upbringing. Public school. 1970, went to first grade, and public school then was not what public school is today, but yet with its influences. And went first grade in a little town called Acme, Washington. And my first grade teacher, that was her last year. She was 60-some years old, 1970. Very strict, a lot of respect in those schools back then. But going through that, I finished ninth grade, and I didn't do so good in high school. The peer pressure, the influence, the bad influences. You would think, well, 50 years ago, it wasn't that bad. It was bad. Just the language, the filthiness. I always tell everybody I learned everything bad in a berry field and in public school. Everything was right there. And my mom, being kind of a visionary, she saw that I wasn't faring out well, and she found a little Christian school. If you're familiar with an ACS-type school, you have different packets. You work through that system, and you have, like, grades kindergarten to maybe 12 in this one room with your little individual thing, and you set your flag up there, and your teacher just roamed around all day. That worked. And but the problem with Christian schools, some people think if you just send your kid to a school, they're going to come out on the other end right. And so they send their bad child to make them a good child. Well, the bad child makes the good child bad. So pretty soon we're dipping snooze in these little cubicles, and we're embarrassing the things we would do in this little Christian school. And, you know, as you get in your teens and you start still hanging around your public school friends, like I said, we lived in this dead-end road, and the farmers and everybody worked together and swam in the same river, and the influence was there. And, you know, I kept saying, well, I said that prayer, I'm a Christian, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to do this, and I'm going to stand strong, right? And I'm going to stand alone. And that works for a while, at least for me. I wasn't maybe strong enough. And, you know, bucking hay with guys, and you're in a big American car. We're going home with maybe 3 or 4 of us in the back seat, a couple guys in the front. Somebody had a case of beer. And, you know, you put it off, you know, I'm not going to do it. And finally, it's just easier to join them than to beat them. And I still remember that first time, pop that bottle and just, you know, why not? Everybody's doing it, and you start drinking. And the problem is, once you do it once, it's easier to do it twice. It's easier to do it again. And so that kind of became, you know, just here and there a little bit, bucking hay. Most of you guys don't know what that is. You don't have big bales back then. Everything had to be thrown on a wagon. But 16, 17, more of that going on. And working in a grocery store then. Some bad influences. And had a Dutch friend down the road. His dad ran a big Dutch dairy. And his parents came just like my parents from Holland, Indonesia, the whole bit. And him and me decided, I said, we were 17, we're going to go see my older sister in California. Like, this is going to be good. And we're going to go down there. And I committed in my heart I wanted to sin. I don't know if you guys ever done that. Just I determined we're going to go down there, we're going to drink, and we're going to have fun. So I jumped in, had a little 65 V-dub, and we were going down I-5, sunroof, and just having a good old time cranking the tunes. Jiving to the music, man. This is going to be a good time. Hook up with my sister. We're at Grandma and Grandpa's, and I said, when we get to your place tonight, let's get something to drink, some alcohol. She goes, yeah, we can do that. And to my shame, that led to a night that didn't end up well with a lot of drinking. But, you know, once you've gotten drunk, it's just easier to do it again. That's just the way life is. It's just easier to do it again. Well, I was a pretty shy guy, and I found that amber courage really makes you feel pretty bold, you know? What I mean by that, drinking makes you, if you're shy, you're not shy. And so the girl you couldn't ask to date, now you can ask, or you could talk to him. And so alcohol really became a drug of choice. It became a regular part of my lifestyle. The drinking allowed me to talk to the girls, the tobacco. And the reason I say tobacco, I meant the form of a round can. Because where I grew up was loggers and dairymen, and it was always, everybody had a little round can, and that intrigued me, that whole thing of the woods. And for some reason, as a young man, that I was drawn to that. And so it was the chewing the snooze, it was the drinking the beer, and but somehow I was still a Christian, you know. Somehow I justified I'm still a Christian, because I can remember back then at 5 in that hallway in California, I said a prayer at one time. I'm a Christian. It's okay. I'm not living right, but I'm a Christian. And I was always drawn to the woods. We just lived in an area, either heard big high lead sides, the whistles going off, or you saw the trucks, and you go down to the little end of the 3-mile road, and there was a railroad track, and you could sit there as a little boy, and you can watch 3 log loads go by all day long, and once in a while a big 1 log load. And it just, in the 70s, that just pulled a young man. That was awesome, right? Logging, and just, it was cool, and that's what I wanted. And so now I'm 18, 19, you know, people say, I don't do it, it's a dead-end road, don't go in the woods, it's just a dead-end road, there's no future, and here I am almost 20, yeah, about 20 years old, and across the street from this little cafe, or across the street from the grocery store is this cafe, and it said right on the wall, choker setter wanted. I said, you know what, I'm going to do it, I'm going to call that number, and I called that guy, and he goes, how much experience do you have? I go, none. Well, we don't need any of that. We already got one of them guys. I said, well, how do I get in there? I need a job. Well, we'll call you. Well, being the dumb Dutchman I am, I called him again. And hello, you again. I said, yeah, you still got that job? He goes, well, I told you we don't need anybody green. I said, well, how am I ever going to learn? I mean, where are you going to start? You don't just come out of thin air and you're going to learn how to do this stuff. Somebody's got to train me. Oh, we'll call you. We get something we need. Anybody? I must have called him 3 or 4 times. Finally, he goes, you know what? Obviously, you're going to keep calling. Why don't you just show up Monday, and I'll take you up on the road crew.
Yes.
Then. So we get up somewhere up in Concrete, Washington. Beautiful, pristine area. Get on the. He's got a D8 cat, and I'm going to set chokers behind this cat. Right-of-way fallers are ready cutting timber in the right-of-way. But the cool thing was, this was an old rail grade where they logged all this timber before via the railroad, and every draw still had the wooden trestles going across the spans and still intact. Some we could walk across. It was 1984. It's all gone now. But really, really cool. And they were going to break in ground on this huge track of virgin timber. And I thought I hit gold as a young buck. I said, man, this is it. This is a dream job. And pretty soon I was working on the big high lead sides and drinking and logging, and I just thought I hit the jackpot. And then from that, just discontent, go from one company, work at another company. You ever heard the term the logger, a logging tramp? I was kind of working out to be a logging tramp, just kind of go from camp to camp and working from here, working from there. And I had this one friend, his name was Ole, and he had a motorcycle, and I did too, and he wanted to go to this place called Sturgis. Anybody know where Sturgis, South Dakota? It's a big Harley thing. Everybody goes there. It's a big drunk. Where were we going to go? I wasn't quite sure how my Honda was going to fit in over there, but he thought we could make it. But I had a mother that didn't like what was going on in my life, and she could see what was going on. And this is kind of for you moms. If you ever have a boy that you're worried about, just keep praying, because my mom prayed so hard that I wouldn't go to this trip. I have no idea what she knew or how she knew that this place couldn't be good. But for some reason, she knew that this place, and she prayed that, Lord, do something. If you got to make him, if you got to hurt him, if you got to give him an accident, don't let him go. And I just started for this another logging company, Barter and Mar Logging. They don't exist anymore. Had a big 100-foot tower, and I was pulling rigging, and we were just off the landing. The logs were just coming to the landing, and for some reason, I was walking into a turn, and a spring-loaded fir limb just smacked my eyeball and just went like that to my eye. And instantly just went black. I finished that turn, got out of the way, blew the whistles, the logs went in, and I figured I better get in, and I went to the side rod. The guy was running the loader. I said, I can't see out of this eye. And he looked at it, and he goes, it's half full of blood. He goes, what happened? I said, I don't know. The stick smacked it. He goes, oh, boy, better get you in. Anyways, long story short, I couldn't do nothing for a month because they were afraid that eye would start bleeding again. So my mother's prayer was answered. I never went on that trip. And when I found out what went on in that Sturgis, I'm glad I didn't go. So the Lord really spared me from that one. My mom's prayer stopped the trip to Sturgis is what I have written down, and that was so true. I can't believe it. Well, then I was discontent with that, and Yarder Engineer had a brother down in North Bend, Washington. God had his hand in there because Carolyn's from North Bend, Washington, so I'm not sure how this was all happening, but some reason I got discontent. I'm going to go work with this guy. We're tramping around over there. Somehow we end up working out of Edumclaw. Edumclaw is kind of by Mount Rainier, if you're not familiar with that area. A lot of timber country. Just short-terming for this guy, working for this guy. And Friday night, there was another guy, Kevin Lundy. He was my height, a little bigger, 6'6". He was the hook tender, kind of the head guy. Friday night, happy hour in Edumclaw. We're drinking in there. We're working our way back to North Bend. In between is a town called Maple Valley. We thought, well, let's hit another bar. The problem was there's a restaurant in the beginning of the bar, and then there's two of these bar doors that swung into this bar. So we walked through the restaurant, and we looked horrible. We were filthy in our rigging clothes, drunk. Parents are grabbing their children. We walked through the door, and we sling the door wide open. The bartender said, get out! I said, well, I guess we're done here. Couldn't even get in, so we just headed right back. Went to North Bend, got kicked out of there, out of that bar. I said, take me to my car. So he took me to my car. We're heading up out of North Bend. It's kind of the old freeway. It was a four lane, and some car hits us. Surprisingly, we didn't hit them, but they hit us. Set that half ton up on its side. I remember crawling out of the door. The tires are still spinning. Set my cork boots and nose bag off to the side. And he gets out, and we just start helping with the firemen. The whole freeway, this thing shut down. The firemen are here, the ambulances. I smacked my head pretty good, but I didn't feel nothing. And they got the jaws of life, and they're cutting the door out. And I just realized, like, that guy's head's under the dash. He's not even moving. And they said, you need to get in the ambulance. You need to get checked out. And we'd crawl out of the ambulance and help again. And found out that two people died in another car. It's like, Lord, how did we get spared? It wasn't our fault. The accident literally was not our fault. They came into our lane. And two people died. I remember the cop brought me to the police station. I wandered home to my apartment. I had a girlfriend at that time, and she'd come by and trying to comfort. I just felt so empty, and I felt so lonely. It just seemed like things just weren't working out. My life was just kind of spiraling. This big accident. We somehow survived it. Her dad come by, and he goes, where's your car? I said, oh, it's up at that parking ride. I'll go get it. He comes back. He goes, how come you don't have a stupid window in your car? I said, I have a window in my car. He goes, you know, glass everywhere. Somebody broke in. I had a camera. I don't know why I always had a big jar of coins. Stole that. Stole all my tapes. Just stripped that car blind. And I remember just sitting there on the side of the bed, and this girl who I didn't love, trying to comfort me, and I just sat there and I just wept. And I just thought, wow, what? This is all life is? And I just sat there and I felt so hollow and empty. And you know, you kind of just rise up above it. And my friend got us a job cutting timber, and I thought, get out of this rigging. The rigging guys are bunch of rats anyways, always drinking, and get around these timber fallers, they're a little cleaner. And I don't think I had a day off or 2 days, maybe a couple days off. They're out there hobbling around, sore from this accident, out there cutting timber. And I had met Carolyn before, but it was real short. And her mom owned a restaurant there in North Bend, and we kind of became friends. And I came to her after that accident, and we talked, and I needed another place to stay or something. And she'd help me look in the little, back then everything was newspaper, you look at the classifieds for places, she'd look and mark things for me. And that summer she was in her mom's cafe, and they were making sandwiches for the firefighters, and she lost some weight, and she was beautiful anyways. Blonde hair, kind of a strawberry blonde, and I'm embarrassing her now. She says, we should go out sometime, see a movie. I said, yeah, we can do that. So we did, and we went out, saw a movie. It was good. Yeah, just like this time it kind of clicked. And then she doesn't want me to say this, but anyways, I'm going to say it anyways. A couple days later, she's like, I don't know, I don't trust you. I don't feel like we should go on. I was like, you got it. Kidding me. Just set a guy up to take him down. And whatever. Move on. And about a week later, the knocks on the door of our apartment, and we lived in a dump. Old two-story wooden shack, coke dealer across the hall, and another guy at the bottom, Steve Craner. I don't think all he ever did is lay around and snort coke. I mean, he was just a waste of a human. Just what a dump. My friend would wake me up with a chainsaw coming up the hall, up the stairs. I mean, that's the kind of place we were living in. It was $200 a month, man. It was a good deal. She knocks on the door, and I'm sitting there with my friend Ole. We're just sitting there watching TV, smoking a cigarette, and she comes in and starts talking to Ole. It's like, what the world? Dump me, now she's hitting up on him. I was just fuming, just sitting there, just looking at that TV, just thinking how, can't believe people do this. And then all of a sudden she goes, hey, I want to talk to you. Okay. We stand out in the hallway. She thought she'd give me another chance. I said, well, I'm not a yo-yo. We're either on or it's off. I'm not going to go back and forth. And she said, no, I'm going to give you a try. Talk to my sister. And just give you a try. I mean, I was probably not your best type. And she was going to give me a try. Well, we started dating, and to our shame, we ended up living together. And my mother always intervened somehow. She had a dream that Carolyn was pregnant, and it bothered me. It hounded me. So I told her, I said, Mom had a dream, you were pregnant, and you know, you're the only person I ever thought I'd marry, and you know, I want to marry a Christian, and I got to start right. I got to start with a Christian, and I'm a Christian. And she said, well, I'm a Christian? I said, good, we're both Christians. This could work. Meanwhile, we're in sin. I don't even know why we thought we were Christian, but we thought we were Christians. Like, this can work. And I don't remember if I just proposed to you or what. I don't know how that worked, but all of a sudden, we're preparing for a wedding. And everybody's on board. This is great. And we're starting to go to church, and this Baptist church, and the guy was good. And it felt like the Lord was doing something, and I quit drinking. And we get married. But I remember we talked to some lady in some place where we were getting her cards, like, what's the secret to marriage? She said, you got to have God first and never have a back door of escape. And I remember we both thought about that. That's good. We're going to keep that. And we got married, ended up buying some property up north close to my parents, lived in a little single wide. Or actually, we lived in a little RV trailer behind my mom and dad. Young people, don't do what we did. We lived rough, man. We were in a single wide little trailer. Then we moved on our property. There again, peer pressure. Started working with new guys. The beer cracking. And pretty soon, I'm nipping on beer again after I quit. And my life starts to go that way. We get disgruntled with some churches. Meanwhile, we're trying to get our property. We had 6 acres. Trying to get our little place set up, new laws passed. You couldn't get electricity unless you had a well. Every well digger was busy. Long story short, we spent a winter without power and water, just living like hippies. But yet we look back, that was a good winter. We actually had a good time and played a lot of Pictionary with my younger sister. And I'll never forget the day the power was hooked up. Carolyn had every light on that trailer house lit up. Big old pizza, and we were so happy. A $5,000 trailer house, no skirting on 6 acres of dirt, and we were thrilled, and it was ours. I spent a lot of Sundays then just driving logging roads and discouraged about church and didn't know where to go. We didn't have any children. Carolyn, I think, had a miscarriage. It go through, and just kind of a dark time in a marriage, you know, just an empty time. Can't remember. She said, you know that little church down there, that grocery store, I think I'm going to go check it out. You want to come? I said, no. Go ahead. Let me know how it works. And she come back, and she said, I think you like that guy. He's kind of fiery. I think you like him. You ought to come. So I went the next Sunday and found out that his brother was the yarder engineer of the first logging company I worked for, so we kind of had a little commonality. And yeah, he was a skinny little bearded preacher, but he could preach. That guy would preach. Tears running down his cheeks. We would listen, and you know, the Holy Spirit told us we weren't saved. We were lost. And we would just, oh man, I remember we would just, after the sermon, we would have our faces in the pew just crying out that God would save us. We were so lost. I never felt a lightning strike. My hair didn't stand on end, but finally things changed. We didn't want to watch the movies we watched. I'd ready to give up drinking because Carolyn was going to leave me. God worked that all out. I hadn't had a drop since. But we finally got born again, and things finally started to change in our life without trying to do it with sheer willpower. The movies became less. We didn't want to go places anymore. We hung out with different people. And then God blessed us with Willem, our firstborn. And we wanted to do it different than the way we were raised. We determined we're not going to send him to public school. We'll homeschool, no school, anything but public school was our motto. And, you know, we didn't do it all right, I'll tell you. We made a lot of mistakes. But God was, he was kind and gracious. Faith come and Isaiah. And, you know, we started getting children in different churches and different settings. And what are we going to do? What's the future? I'll just say one thing. The easy road out is go get your have your wife get a job, send your children to public school. That's the easy way. Make money and lose your family. That's the easy way. We didn't want to do that. Got a last denominational church we ended up being in was like an independent King James only fired up Baptist church. Women wore dresses. First experience of modesty and all of that. And we kind of revolted against some of that, but there was some good teaching there. But some of them guys, they just get kind of stuck in a rut. They just rapture every Sunday and this and just their doctrines. And finally, we ended up in a home church and listening to some guy from Wisconsin and this David Meyer, who's no longer living. And we're home churching and Saturday night, we'd be in a prayer meeting, and somebody brings this tape, and it's Brother Denny. I didn't know the guy from Adam, and he preached on the house churches in China, and it really resonated with me, that sermon. Really spoke to our heart. And can I get a tissue or something? Just a tissue. Thank you. And I asked my wife, I said, find out on that end. They said free gospel tapes to all that would ask. And she checked that out, and we got this catalog and all these tapes. And it was just very intriguing and that they didn't want money because everybody seemed like they wanted money. And we thought that a lot of the teaching we felt was very biblical. Thank you, Roger.
Here's a drink, too, for good measure.
Thank you. And this little home church was a wild group. These were wild people. We were into conspiracy. We had M16s. I mean, we were going to take on the UN. I mean, that's the kind of group we were. A lot of older single guys and target practice on the weekends. That's to just let you know, this is the kind of peeps we were hanging around. And I was the only one with children. The other ones were either older or they had no children or they were divorced and didn't remarry. But we were in a motley crew home church. It was good. I mean, I'm glad the Lord brought us through it, to be honest with you. We learned from it. And but this Brother Denny was family, right? We had family, and this is family and the godly home. And it's like, good grief, how are you going to do this? And I go back to Wisconsin where this Pastor Meyer, we're listening to him, and he wants to ordain me for the house church because a lot of these people were part of this house church, listening to him. He didn't believe in the military or politics, fighting, war. He wasn't Anabaptist or anything, but for some reason he just thought that was nonsense. You vote for him, it's good cop, bad cop. It just wasted time. So he actually was getting some foundation work for us. I'm going back to get ordained. I meet a guy from a charity church from South Dakota, Jonathan Leon. Some of you probably remember him. Never met this guy from Adam. He's here. He's getting baptized. And he meets us, and he's telling me about his wife wearing this head covering thing. I go, what the world? He goes, yeah, we're going to this church, these charity guys. And I said, well, yeah, I listen to Brother Denny. And he goes, yeah, that's the real deal, man. I go, what's this head covering? He said, you see all these women here? We were like in a holiness. This group was like holy. They're all wearing dresses and long hair. He goes, but you roll that hair up and you cover it. I go, okay. And then what? Well, you cover it. And then he goes, men open doors for my wife. And he goes, it's weird. I said, so you wear this thing all the time? What? Yeah, you can wear it. It's bad. I go, how'd you figure out? Where'd you learn about this? I'm going to inject a little clause. I didn't know what a Mennonite was from a Jebusite at that time, okay? I had no clue. I knew Amish wore big black hats and had buggies. That's all I knew. Didn't know what a Mennonite was. These charity thing people, they're different. And I said, that's interesting. So what's with this? What's with the covering, though? I mean, how do you play it out? And he goes, well, they got these tapes. So listen to them. I'm telling Carolyn about this covering. She goes, that's dumb. We're wearing dresses already. Like, yeah, what's with that? I said, I don't know. He said, people open doors for you, and there's it's blessing, and there's, I don't know, I think we ought to look into it. And, I've just, my whole life, just always looking for truth, but, a lot of times stumbling through things and end up, hopefully at the end, it comes out. But I was always never satisfied where I was at once we got really good saved. She ordered some tapes. I don't remember who. You remember who the guy that taught him? Was it Mast? Yeah, it was the old man Mast, Dryas' dad. I can't think of his name right now. Huh? Yeah. Anyways, he did a... So we ordered the tapes. Carolyn listened to the series, and... I was working, chopping trees and trying to raise children. And she goes, wow, that's something. I go, what? She goes, that head covering. I go, well, what about it? She goes, well, doesn't really leave a loophole. I go, what do you mean? It's either you do or you don't. I mean, it's pretty black and white. And I said the hair is the covering. She goes, no. Use a mannequin and you go through that thing. It's a literal covering. And I said, well, I guess you want to do it? She goes, well, yeah, let's do it. So remember, we don't even know what a Mennonite is, let alone covering. She just went online and found something, and these little lacy things show up online or on the mail, and her and Faith pin one on. And now the house church people showed up, and that's when the demons came out. Woo! You guys are radical. I knew you were going to do this. I suppose we're supposed to wear one now. And it got heated up. No, we didn't say that. We just feel led by the Lord to do this. And, I thank the Lord for a wife and a daughter that was just willing, kind of like blind faith, just submit and do it. Well, we realized our house church wasn't going to work anymore and that we need to do something different. And listening to the tapes and mailman, the post office in Deming, he knew me. I get these stupid, huge boxes of charity tapes. I'm handing them out everywhere, and we're eating them up and just listening and trying to go through this home church, and then realizing in the back of the deal they had fellowship finders. And so we called up a couple of them, and one of them was in... Jamie Gordon there in Ellensburg, and we visited there, and my Elijah was a baby. Hope wasn't even born, I don't think. And going over there, and that didn't bear witness, and went to Colorado, and Loveland, Colorado, met with some brothers there, and then we called us one in Halsey, Oregon. There was a guy named Jake Wilcoxon. Anybody know Jake Wilcoxon? Yeah, he was on the back of the list. I called this guy up. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I thought that guy was 120 pounds. He just was a wiry, fired-up little guy. And I told Carolyn, I said, man, he's excited about his church at least. Some other guys just kind of mope through everything. And he's fired up. And some drywall guy, and so he just sounds like a little fiery little 120-pound guy. And anyway, I can't remember all what happened. We moved around, and Brother Denny was going to come here, and he invited me on an answering machine, said, come to Halsey, Denny's going to be here, and we were on a trip or something. Anyway, I called him back and say, yeah, I didn't miss it. Thanks for the invite, yada, yada. He says, hey, how about we come and see you? What? No, how about my family come up and see you? Well, that was different for us. Like, you don't do that. I don't know you. He goes, yeah, we'll just come up and, you know, we'll just spend the weekend with you and just bless you. Does that sound like Jake? I told my wife, I said, are you ready for this? Five girls, I think, and him and his wife. And, okay, let's be adventurous, you know, stretch out. We lived rural, and I said, I'll meet you at the little gas station down there at Deming, and I'll meet you there. You follow me home. So I'm waiting, and here's some white Dodge van plastered with scripture. And this is my hometown. I'm like, good. And this 120-pound guy ain't 120 pounds. He's 320 pounds. And then his wife came out, and she wasn't skinny. And I'm thinking, verses everywhere. What did I mean? This is different. And I was embarrassed. Sorry, Roger, that was your van. That was your van. It was the white van. Yeah, because his wouldn't run that far. And he followed me home, and I tell you, he was a salesman. He had a picture of everybody in the church, and he was flicking these pictures out like a salesman. And I'm just looking over at the big beards, thinking, who on earth are these bearded guys? But we were interested. And yeah, all my children were there. His children and I, they were just, you know, Sarah Beth was old, all down. And I had a few little red flags that popped off that weekend. But as a whole, we were really blessed. I was kind of a Pharisee, judgmental a little bit. And he kind of toned some of that out. And he got us interested coming to Halsey. And I forget when we made our first trek down. But I remember coming down and we stayed with Shane O'Terry. And yeah, we were blessed. And then the next time, I think it was Milionis, and we stayed with Wilcoxon once, and we prayed about it, and we were going to leave Washington. We were going to leave everything. 36 years I had of deep roots, all my work, all my connections, all my family, everything there. And he said, we need to do it. We need to do it for our family. Who are they going to marry here? Who are they going to be with? Hope was... When we moved to Oregon, Hope was 1 year old. And today she's 20, 21, 20. Elijah was 3 or so, just young. But so we made plans to move. And that's hard to do when you've been in a place a long time. It's hard to leave everything behind. It's hard to let go of your work. And I didn't move to Oregon for work. I just knew there was trees, and I knew how to put them on the ground. And that was it. I left it at that. God's going to provide. So we prepare that fall. We prepare. J.D. Evans came out, helped paint her house. Bless his heart. His whole family came out. They had a ball, and they painted her house. And we started making preparations, doing flooring, getting her house ready to sell. And we got it on the market. And realtor was excited. The place looks great. It just shows perfect. I wish everybody's house would look this nice. And nobody wanted to buy it. It'd sit on the market and sit there. And then the seeds of discouragement come in. I wonder if we're supposed to go to Oregon. I wonder if maybe we missed God's plan. Grandma gets sick. She needs our attention. Get this big Ford pickup I want to sell because it's a lemon. And can't get rid of it. Grandma's sick. The house won't sell. Work was slow, and then these big jobs come up. I was working for myself with another guy. And Carolyn's discouraged. And we're just like, we're in a dip. What are we going to do? Praying, fasting, felt like we still need to go, but why is nothing moving? Why is it just stagnant? And then this big job comes up, and I said, well, maybe the Lord wants to give us a little shot in the arm, you know, I need a little more money, and timber was big, bid it pretty good. I can't remember the right sequence, but it's either, how was that, Carolyn? We either said we're going to go, or all of a sudden, Grandma got better. We got a full cash price offer from somebody from L.A. Came and paid cash, so there was no bank holdup, house sold like that. And somebody from Dallas bought that Ford pickup because I still had payments on it. I didn't want to have any debt. And Grandma gets a second wind and ended up living for 2 more years. And I remember Carolyn one time behind the house, we had a little brook. Well, when it was raining, there was a little creek there. And she got back there and she was just crying out, kind of our prayer spot, crying out to the Lord, saying, Lord, how are you going to feed us? We don't have a job. We don't have anything. You know, just women want to have security. They want to know. They want to have a feeling that this is going to work out for them. And the guy's like, ah, it'll work. Just, you know, figure something out. And she's crying out to the Lord. And she goes, how are we going to feed my babies and all that? And a raven, big old raven come on a branch with a hunk of bread. Said, thank you, Lord, for the sign. You will take care of us. And he did. We moved. We bought a place up in Crawfordsville, and I had to go work for somebody else, and we were so broke. I couldn't even buy beauty bark. It just seemed like all I did was work, and it just, things were different. And I felt the church was great, it was a blessing to us, but at times I'd wait at the crummy stop and I'd just sit there and cry. All my friends, all my connections, here I am in this foreign land, and I just felt so lost. But I knew we made the right decision, but I just didn't feel it. And we worked and we worked, and somehow, I'm not going to get into it, but we ended up going to the Mennonite church, and that came with its own challenges, and we put our children some in the day school there, and now we've been here in April, it'll be 20 years in Oregon. I could never think about going back to Washington. There's nothing there for me anymore. And Oregon's our home. And then in end of 14, we had an opportunity to go to Haiti with our whole family and for CAB. And we spent almost 3 years there. And through that blessing, I ended up with two daughter-in-laws because of all the people that visited through there. So I have 5 children, and here they sit, and I think of the decision of my dad coming to America. I think of the decision, maybe him not knowing, but breaking away from the darkness, breaking away from the family ties, and, you know, I look back, your life story gets longer as you get older. And seeing what the Lord has done, how he worked through this. You can't make this up. You can never write this out. And so, as I become an older man, I feel truly overly blessed, overly grateful for what the Lord has done in our life. And like I said, I made a lot of mistakes. And if I had to do some things over again, I'd probably do them different. But I did always want to pursue the Lord, and that was my heart. And my heart is that my children would pursue the Lord hard too. But the second generation is not quite the same. And they got to fight their own battles and their own giants. And so I just want to say, Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. It wasn't to that time when that happened that we truly lived for the Lord. The sinner prayer made me a decent person. But it wasn't until I got good, till my wife and me got good saved, that God was able to truly work and put us on a path that would give him glory. I think we're out of time. I'm going to leave it at that. So thank you for listening to that story. Every time I go through this, it humbles me. It humbles me greatly what God can do for a person that's just willing to listen and follow. And so Lord bless you in this.